This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In 1971, the world was in the midst of the Green Revolution. Advances in agriculture more than doubled grain yields, and yet people starved the world over.
A young author named Frances Moore LePay wanted to know why. She calculated that in the American agricultural system, it takes 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of meat. Her hugely successful book, Diet for a Small Planet, provided a practical guide for people who wanted to satisfy their protein needs with less meat and take pressure off the global food supply.
LePay now runs the Small Planet Institute in Cambridge, and in her latest writing, she argues that basic assumptions that we have about the world's problems, we've hit the limits of a finite planet, for example, are wrong. Problems from global warming to income inequality, she says, have obvious systemic solutions. Her new book is called EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want.
And going back to Diet for a Small Planet, LePay knows she made a lot of vegetarian converts with that book, but that's not necessarily the change in thinking she was trying to provoke.
What I really wanted people to do was more actually what I'm writing about today. I wanted people to look at what are the underlying assumptions that end up creating an economic system that feeds all of this massive amount of grain to animals. I don't think anybody sat around in the 50s. I didn't know anyone who said, yes, my meat is too lean. I want fatty, grain-fed meat. Oh, I don't want just this small portion. I want 8 12-ounce steaks. I mean, I don't think there was a huge outcry for that. I think that was constructed because of the great burst in yields that meant there was so much grain that to make profit from it, you needed to create a more of a luxury item, that is grain-fed meat, and then say that this is the best. And that was how it was graded, you know, that the most fatty grain-fed cuts of meat were graded the highest. And I remember an ad in a magazine that said, had a picture of a, you know, really juicy filet mignon that was obviously very fatty and said, the meat you'd serve to impress your brother-in-law. I'm not sure why that particular angle, but the idea that we were sold this because of an economic construct that creates such vast, vast deprivation.
So now we come to your new book, EcoMind. And in my interpretation, you've essentially taken that way of thinking that you applied to the food system and Diet for a Small Planet and applied it to the entire world.
Everything.
Everything.
Everything in human relationships.
And you challenge these 7 thought traps. What is a thought trap?
Well, thought trap is just one piece of a mental map, I call it. One of the things I've learned over these decades, helped by many great thinkers, is that we human beings actually don't see the world as it is, but as we are. In other words, through culturally absorbed filters. And that's okay. That's just who we are. If. The filter, the mental map, is life-serving. But the thesis of EcoMind is you and I are alive at this moment where the dominant mental map through which we're seeing is fundamentally, perversely aligned with our own nature, what makes us thrive, and with wider nature. And that's a huge problem. Can I just tell you one little story about the power of the mental map?
Sure.
Last Thanksgiving, I got up in the morning ready to make my favorite root vegetable dish. And I knew exactly where my Dutch oven was to start cooking. And I went to the cupboard and wasn't there. I looked in another cupboard. I looked in the basement. I got so frustrated, I finally gave up. But about an hour later, I turned around, and there it was. Only I had put a plant in it. So it had shifted from the frame of a kitchen item to a planter. And so I couldn't see it, even though it is red and quite large. And so this to me symbolizes the power of the mental map, that my mental map overrode, you know, the obvious things in my kitchen that day until I kind of flipped out of it. But what I'm saying is that we hear seeing is believing, but actually believing is seeing. And so we need to question, and I think human beings are capable of it, what are the core assumptions that form that limiting map through which we see?
So give me an example of something that we don't see, even though it's right in front of us.
Well, the core premise of the dominant mental map is lack. scarcity. Scarcity of goods and scarcity of goodness, meaning that there's not enough of anything. That's the core. There's not enough energy, there's not enough food, and there's not enough goodness in human nature. And that's the beginning of the spiral of powerlessness, which is the core problem. In other words, I argue here that solutions are known. It's just that we, most of us, feel powerless to manifest them. So the kind of thought traps that I talk about, that I tease out from this broader mental map, are, for example, the idea that we've hit the limits of a finite planet. This is locked in the premise of scarcity. And from that, we then actually feel increasingly disempowered.
Well, so let's drill down on one of those. You talk about energy. There's a widely believed or perceived sense of energy scarcity in this country right now, or at least a scarcity of sustainable energy. And you essentially argue that that's bogus.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I think this whole idea of we've hit the limits, it's problematic on many counts. It engenders fear, and that makes us actually more materialistic and self-centered. But even a deeper level, I think, is that it diverts us from what's right in front of our noses, that we in this country, scientists estimate, from 55% to 87% of energy use in the U.S. is, or energy in the U.S. is wasted. Of a typical power plant, 2/3 of the energy entering the plant is wasted. Food, over 40% of the food in the U.S. is wasted. Globally, the estimate is 1/3. So I think we have to move from this quantitative frame of hit the limits to the qualitative one. What are the relationships of power that inevitably create waste and destruction? And that's what I go into then in the first chapter.
Well, bringing it back to energy, which you deal with in the first chapter in some detail, you talk about the Fukushima nuclear disaster and how even in spite of the horror, the continuing horror of that incident, there is still an attitude expressed at the highest levels of our government that nuclear power, problematic as it may be, is probably our best option going into the future.
And you even hear some environmentalists saying that.
Sure.
So I counter that by explaining what I think is more and more obvious, and certainly a lot of people in Occupy Wall Street now talking about it, that what we have today is privately held government, that the power of private wealth is so great that it has so distorted our public decision-making that we can't think straight about something like nuclear power. We're not made aware of the something of, you know, on the order of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies, both public and ratepayer subsidies, that have gone into the development of nuclear power. And so that we think of it as a viable alternative without realizing that it's only because of our own sacrifices and subsidies that have made it look cheap.
And you point out that there's basically three really big corporations that make nuclear power plants, one of them being GE, second largest company in the world, all extraordinarily powerful and thus very influential in government. That said, you know, implicit in the entire concept of the book is that, in fact, there is no scarcity. There is enough energy for us to live the way that we want to live. We just have to find it elsewhere and not be influenced by GE to find it somewhere that is not the best place to find it. But what is the best place to find it? I mean, you talk about renewable energy. Year in, year out, we're covering Cape Wind here, this unbelievably problematic project, this massive, massive thing that's going to provide, at the end of the day, half the electricity they need on the Cape? Really?
Well, I'm saying in this book that we haven't begun to try. For example, Germany.
Lots of nuclear power in Germany.
Yes, true. But think what's happening with renewables. And because of one piece of legislation, a very simple law, there it's called the feed-in tariff, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me in American English, so I call it the reward renewables law. It's now in 60 other countries and provinces, where basically you just say to householders that we, the government, will ensure that you get a certain return for your investment if you put a solar panel or install a small wind unit, that you will get a return that will pay for your investment. And now 80% of the renewable energy units in Germany are household owned, and Germany is on track to be 40% renewable energy in less than 10 years for electricity.
We're talking to Frances Moore LePay. She's the author in 1971 of Diet for a Small Planet, which has sold 3 million copies at this point. She's now the author of a new book called EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. I understand what you're trying to do here, Frances. You're trying to counter fatalistic environmentalism, right? The attitude amongst environmentalists out there that we're in really, really deep trouble and we're going to all have to radically change our expectations for life if we have any chance of solving the problems that we're going to solve.
Actually, what I'm trying to do here is to counter the feeling of powerlessness that people have and to show that actually there are ways that we can get our democracy back, that these choices of moving, say, to continue with nuclear rather than really going in the direction I pointed to that Germany has gone to with renewable energy. Those are political decisions. We have to have a real democracy answering to us, right, the citizens. So privately held government is not good enough. We need what I call living democracy, and that means getting the power of private wealth out of the driver's seat in Washington.
Okay, so you've broken me out of that thought trap, all right? Let's just say this for the sake of argument. I've accepted the notion that there is plenty of energy to be had in this country. We just need to establish an economic system that will register the proper inputs to effectively give us sustainable, efficient energy production.
And of course, I started out with the enormous waste built into our current system. So a lot of what we know we need to do is to address that incredibly wasteful use of energy that's built in now to our system.
Okay, I'm broken out of the mind trap. Now what do I do? I still have the completely deadlocked political system that can't even agree on $1 trillion worth of cuts with 12 guys in a room. What do I do now?
Well, one, we start naming the problem. And that's challenging. I mean, yes, I'm excited about Occupy Wall Street, and I'm also aware that the way the media has framed their main call is corporate greed. The problem is corporate greed. Well, yeah, but not really. I mean, what I'm saying is that if we look at it from thinking like an ecosystem, in other words, if we think of it in terms of what are the conditions that create the expression of any organism, then we see that indeed, probably, if we had tested those Wall Streeters who were creating the toxic derivatives, and if we tested them on a greed meter before they took those jobs, they probably wouldn't have been greedier than any of us. But we all were complicit in creating the lack of rules, the lack of transparency that enabled them to operate in secrecy with incredible power to create a nightmare for the rest of us in terms of economic collapse. So the yes, we can is to say it is possible and we know how to get money out of politics. We have to create a voluntary public financing system, and we have to, as citizens, say we're not going to vote for you unless if you take corporate money, as they all are doing now, but with a viable public financing system, they would not have to. And there are two bills now in Congress that would begin to put in place that kind of system. Obama tomorrow could sign an executive order saying that anyone who takes a government contract, any corporation, has to divulge its political contributions. That would begin to open up this whole question of who is actually the funder behind the political decision.
Frances Moore LePay, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Frances Moore LePay is the co-founder of the Small Planet Institute in Cambridge. Her latest book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want.
Stay with us. Up next, author Christian McEwen on why a slower life may be a better life. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.